Sensory integration, or sensory processing, is a process by which the brain takes in and makes sense of the information that we get from our senses. So let me ask you a question. What are the five senses? Shout them out by typing them in your text box. Ready? Go. Great job. You all passed kindergarten. Now let's see what happens if some of these senses are derailed. That is, we sense too much or too little, or we reinterpret the sense. Let's start with taste, a simple one. Let's say Yehuda cannot taste accurately. How might that be expressed? There are several possibilities based on his unique neurological wiring. One possibility is that he had an underdeveloped sense of taste, so he craves spicy food like barbecue chips and spicy mustard to ramp it up. Another possibility is that he has an underdeveloped sense of taste, but will barely eat food because food is totally unsatisfying. Another possibility is that he is super sensitive to taste, so super sensitive to taste that he's a very picky eater. Not good for a Jewish mother. Let's try that with hearing. Assuming that there is no frank hearing loss, there are several possibilities. If Shira can't tune into sound, she won't respond when you call her name. You might interpret that as rude and disrespectful, but perhaps Shira can't distinguish your voice from the other sounds in the environment, such as airplanes, the radiator hissing, and the chatter of the other kids in the house. On the other hand, if Shira was overly responsive to sound, she might be anxious about the vacuum, the TV volume, noise at the dinner table, and refuse to get on the school bus. One more example, touch. If Ezra was hypersensitive to touch, he may shy away from other kids because their inadvertent touch might feel like insult. However, if he didn't have enough feeling in his skin, he might grab a hold of everything and everyone around him and tug at Ema's hair whenever he could get close. But there are two senses that you never learned in kindergarten. They are proprioception and the vestibular sense. Proprioception is the muscle and the joint sense. The receptors in your joints and muscles tell you precisely where your body parts are at all times and how they are related to each other. In order to illustrate this really difficult concept, let's do an experiment. And since I can't tell you, I'm counting on you to be with me. Okay. Everybody close your eyes. I'm waiting for all of you. Okay. Now, touch your shoulders. By clicking on the hand icon, raise your hand if you were able to do that. Super. All right. I see we have a consensus here. Okay. What enabled you to do that? What sensation enabled you to do that? Type it in the chat box if you think you know. Take a guess. Okay. Touch lets you know that you actually got your hands to your shoulder. But here, proprioception is the key because it tells you exactly where your arms are in relationship to your body every step of the way. Your children rely on proprioception every day, for example, to bring the spoon to their mouth when they can no longer see it, or button the button without looking at their shirt. Proprioception also enables them to climb a rock wall or monkey bars without looking at their feet, and hug just the right amount, not so hard that they knock their friends over, because that would be off-putting and socially disastrous. The other sense that we didn't learn in kindergarten is the vestibular sense. The vestibular sense is the sensory system that responds to changes in head position and movement. It helps us coordinate our eyes, head, and body and enables us to feel the pull of gravity. Our vestibular sense enables us to feel if we are right side up or upside down. It lets us know if we are going slow or fast. It lets us know when we are diving in the water, which is the way up. For our purposes, the most important part of the vestibular system is its coordination with the touch sense and the proprioceptive sense to impart to our children a sense of their body and space. Our sense of body and space tells us where we are in relationship to other people in our environment and to other objects so that we can walk, navigate a straight path, let's say from the kitchen to the front hallway without tripping over everybody and everything in between. If children's tactile, proprioceptive, and vestibular senses are not fine-tuned, they may feel like they are lost in space. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the Dr. Seuss book, The Fish Out of Water, but this quote encapsulates what we've been discussing. A boy buys a fish named Otto from a pet store. The store owner gives the boy explicit instructions on how to care for the fish, including strict feeding instructions. Never feed him a lot, never more than a spot. Where something may happen, you never know what. When the boy feeds him too much, Otto begins to echo the fishbowl, and then the phases, and then the bathtub, usually floods the house and has to be taken to the local pool. If children get too much or too little stimulation or interpret it the wrong way, their behavior will be altered, similar to Otto. Otto cannot act like a typical fish if he has too much food. Similarly, each child needs the appropriate amount of sensory stimulation for their individual nervous system. Now, most children get just the right amount of sensation, not too much and not too little, from everyday life. And they're able to modulate their responses to it. They go with the flow. They easily tolerate change. They don't get crazy if it's too loud or if it's too bright or if you're too high up. And they're always up for a challenge. Also, they understand their body well enough to play at any playground and learn a sport reasonably well, given a modicum of effort. Let's go back to Chaim and interpret his behavior and reinterpret his behavior through the lens of sensory integration. Okay. Now our answers might be different from our original. Raise your hand if you think Chaim's resistance to dressing, eating, and toothbrushing is due to bad behavior. Put your hands down. Raise your hand if you think eating with his hands is the result of bad manners. Put your hands down. Chaim refuses to go to shul groups and birthday parties because he has poor social skills. And now raise your hand if you think Chaim is stubborn and defiant because he is spoiled. And I think you guys are mostly thinking in the right direction. We will later on reinterpret his behavior and explain how his sensory system can derail him in all of these situations. Let's get on to our camp form. The next question asks you to provide strategies that work well for you at home so that we can help your child in camp or in school. This will require us to view your child's behavior through the prism of sensory integration. When you do that, you can implement sensory solutions at home and provide guidance for home and school. This is a really important point now. If a child has a sensory problem and you try to sticker charge it out of existence, it won't work. A sensory problem mandates sensory strategies. And a problem that's behavioral in origin warrants behavioral strategies. To review, there are 7 senses, and being overly or underly sensitive to any of them can cause a disruption of behavior. So let's practice using these sensations by reinterpreting Chaim's behavior through the lens of sensory integration. Let's take it step by step. 1, Chaim's resistance to dressing, eating, and brushing his teeth can be due to hypersensitivity to touch that affects his skin and his mouth. 2, he eats with his hands to heighten his sense of touch. Yes, you heard me right. Hypersensitivity and hyposensitivity often exist in the same child. As strange as that may seem, that is a very common and very puzzling phenomenon to most parents and people who deal with children.
Chaya, you know what? Can you take a second just to review with hyper and hypo?
Sure. Okay. Yes. Okay. Let me just take a step back for a minute and review what I mean by hypersensitive and hyposensitive. When you are typically sensitive, let's say, to noise, you can tolerate a wide range of noise, but if you're a hypersensitive to noise, the tiniest bit of noise is absolutely overwhelming. So if we can normally have a conversation, let's say, in the pizza store, and most of us can tolerate it, a child with a hypersensitive auditory system might really be derailed and really to the ears just with the noise in the pizza store. I commonly see this at circle time. The children who really are hypersensitive to noise will cover circle time when there's noise. Similarly, a child who's much too sensitive to touch will withdraw from situations in which there's touch, such as being close to other kids. If somebody taps them on the shoulder, they may absolutely withdraw. That's hypersensitive. Children who are hyposensitive, on the other hand, don't feel what's going on around them. A child who's hyposensitive to touch, for example, may come to circle time and sit on another, not even realizing that he's sitting on a kid and not another object, because his tactile system does not give him enough information. Does that help? Okay, let's go on with Chaim, and I'll try to explain my terminology a little more completely. Okay, Chaim refuses to go to shul groups and birthday parties because his nervous system is assaulted by sights, sounds, and close proximity of lots of children who are unpredictable. Birthday parties are the worst, because Chaim has no idea who will be there or what will happen. And fourth, Chaim's apparent stubbornness and defiance is an effort to keep everything the same, because the worst thing that can happen to a child who is overwhelmed by their senses is change. And children work very, very hard at keeping everything the same so that nothing unexpected happens. Chaim is one kind of child who has sensory processing disorder. But what exactly is SPD? Sensory processing disorder is a glitch in the way we take in, process, and act on information from our bodies and our surroundings. When all their systems are primed, children can attend to what they need to, ignore what's irrelevant, and manage their behavior, easily follow directions, play with their friends, and learn new skills. When they have SPD, they are too sensitive to sound and hear things they shouldn't, like the airplanes outside the room and children in the next room and the TV on the floor below. When they're distracted by all of these sensations that they should be suppressing, they can't function in the way they're supposed to, and they spend all of their time either being distracted by what they should never hear or see or feel, and are unable to let it go and do what they're supposed to be doing, whether it's playing the trends on the floor or doing their homework. Who are the kids with sensory processing disorder? They might be on the autistic spectrum, they might have ADHD, or they might have a learning disability. But they are equally likely to be children who are smart or even brilliant, who do not feel comfortable in their own skin and spend a monumental amount of energy making themselves feel okay. Subsequently, they exhibit a range of behaviors to compensate for their disordered sensations. There are two primary products of sensory processing. One is self-regulation, and the other is motor planning. So let me explain. The first goal of sensory processing is self-regulation. Your child's brain is constantly bombarded with sensations. To function optimally, the brain needs to filter out the irrelevant ones, which make your child overwhelmed and anxious, and attend to only the most salient information. Your child needs enough sensory input to stay alert and calm, not so much that she is lethargic, and not so much that she's overwhelmed and anxious. Children who are well-regulated, they take in the right amount of information, remain alert and attentive throughout the day without interrupting themselves or others. They can follow directions in a timely fashion, not in a time delay. They go with the flow, and they transition easily. A poorly regulated child will be driven by the need to reduce or seek out sensations to excess.
Chaya, we had a question from Kira. She was wondering if both children who are hypo and hyper will try to create an environment that is consistent for themselves. Does that occur in both situations?
What do you mean by a consistent environment?
Remember, you had said that children, predictable, they try to maintain a predictable environment. Will they both seek out predictability, both types?
Yes, most children with sensory processing disorder will seek out predictability. Children who are hypersensitive, they can't stand the touch and the sound and the visual stimuli that the rest of us can. They strive the most for predictability. Kids who don't get enough sensation can strive for predictability one kind of child, but another child is seeking novelty every second of the day. They don't feel enough, so they seek out more touch. They touch everything on the floor. They touch all of their friends. They pet the dog too hard. They pet the baby too hard. They pick up all the lint on the floor, and there's nothing on the table that they don't pick up. There is no fish in a tank that they won't look at, and they can stop dead in their tracks to look at everything in the mall. So there are two different kinds of children, those who seek predictability and sameness, and those who predict a second-to-second novelty to feed their sensory system, because no matter how much sound or sight or touch or movement they get, it's never enough. They have such a high threshold. Does that answer the question?
It does. And Yael asked, and I think you said this earlier, but can children be hypo in one area and hyper in another area, in another sense? Can it coexist?
Absolutely. When we create a sensory profile for a child, we look to see if they feel too much of one thing and too little of another thing. In a typical profile, the typical sensory profile is not typical because no two children have the same combination of being hypersensitive to one thing and hyposensitive to another thing. The most puzzling children are the children who touch and feel and grab and don't let anything be near them without touching it and squeezing it and mushing it. But if they get the tiniest little paper cut, they're hysterical. Okay. And if somebody touches them by accident, they withdraw as if they were assaulted. Those children exist optimally in a very, very narrow range of sensory stimulation, and it's very hard for them to find the happy medium of where there's not too much or too little. Okay, let's talk about the second product of good sensory processing, and that is motor planning. When children process touch and movement sense adequately, they develop an accurate sense of how their bodies are wired and how to fit their bodies into the physical world. They use this to join in the playground play, to join in a group of children who are playing. You know, children play in time and space. In order for you to fit yourself into children's play, let's say two children are building a tower. You've got to watch the children building, and you've got to figure out how to go through those children, pick up your blocks, and put them on that tower while navigating your way through those children, figuring out where they're up to and fitting your movements in smoothly. That requires motor planning. Working independently in school and following directions for movement also require good motor planning. Most self-respecting children will run into a playground, instantly engage with whatever structures are around them and do it well, even if it's a brand new playground. The child who doesn't have such good motor planning will run into the playground all excited and stop short. He's going to remain on the outside. He could potentially remain on the outside looking in as he struggles to figure out how to fit his body into those slides, those swinging bridges, and the monkey bars. He may wait till everyone else leaves the playground so that he can try on his own or ask mommy to help. In circle time, these are the children who have difficulty learning the hand movement songs and are on a permanent time delay. Their movements always seem to be a couple of steps behind everybody else. As they get older, they struggle to learn sports and participate in PE. They're often on the outside looking in at recess, and that's really a very sad thing, to see a child on the side being best friends with a teacher and reading a book. So, now it's your turn. What can we do as parents? The most successful approach I have found is a two-pronged intervention. The first prong is intense treatment by an occupational therapist in a sensory gym to alter the way the brain processes sensory input. This is a process and not an overnight fix. And while it is underway, children and parents still need to survive everyday life at home and in school, and that's where you come in. The second prong is a consistent home program to help the child and family cope with everyday life, to survive and perhaps even to thrive. I've broken down the home program into four steps, which are summarized in this slide, three of which we're going to discuss, but hopefully you can do the fourth on your own after this webinar. Number one, figure out which sensory systems are derailing your child. That requires detective work, and it often requires the help of an occupational therapist, which you can make a start. The second is to promote self-regulation proactively. That's where the sensory diet comes in. You want to provide sensory strategies before behavior falls apart. The third part is to be prepared for the most challenging times of the day, and I will go through some of what parents have identified the most challenging times of the day and provide strategies for each one. So number one, your first job is detective work. Your child will give you clues about his sensory needs. When you observe him, don't just note good behavior, bad behavior. Look at what he's actually doing with his body. What's he drawn to? What does he crave? What does he avoid? I'll give you an example. Let's say your child is disrupted during mealtime, and mealtimes are a disaster in your house. Let's look at what the child is doing and try to interpret it. Is he running away from the table? Is he touching his siblings? Well, running away might signal disrespect. Alternatively, your child may be escaping from sensory overload because the sounds and the sights and the smells and all of the kids yelling and talking across the table are overwhelming him. Or he may be uncomfortable with the proximity of the child next to him. Or he may need more movement or he can't sit up. Touching siblings at the table might indicate that he wants to pick a fight. Alternatively, it may indicate that he craves touch, or he has no idea where his body ends and their bodies begin. Each of these strategies signals another issue and mandates a different strategy. Each of these signals require different strategies. When several behaviors stack up in one sensory system, that may indicate that there is a problem processing information in that sensory system. Occupational therapists are experts at detecting these patterns of behavior, but they rely on parents to be accurate reporters of what they see at home. Very important. Your next job is to look for patterns of behavior. What is happening when your child decompensates? And if you keep a log, you might be very surprised. For example, does it always happen in a crowd, such as a mall, a birthday party, groups, a perm suda? Or does he always decompensate when he needs to process a sequence of verbal instructions, such as go upstairs, get your shoes and socks, then come down and get in the car? Or does it invariably happen when there's a schedule change, such as an unplanned play date, a day off from school, or coming back from winter break? The next thing to look for is antecedents to the behavior. What happens right before this child decompensates? For example, every time grandma comes to visit and wants a hug and a kiss, your child runs away and you are mortified. Once you have identified the triggers to his or her typical coping patterns, you can use that information to help prevent a breakdown. So here's your step two. Step two in the home program is to promote self-regulation proactively. That means prime the child's sensory system before there's any, to minimize any behavioral outcomes that are unfavorable. Don't forget, children really want, I take it as a given that children really want to please the adults in their environment. When children are unable to do that and they are operating on a sensory basis, their sensory needs are so overwhelming that they're fighting their sensory system to do what they should, they get negative feedback. Children aren't looking for negative feedback. So I really believe that if children could control their behavior based on sensory-driven behavior, they would. So what I'd like to do is help children refrain from exhibiting behavior that's going to generate negative feedback. So we're going to promote their ability to regulate their behavior before it ever breaks down, like pain management. If you feel a headache coming on and you take Tylenol or Advil right away, usually your headache tapers off. But if you wait until the headache escalates, you can't function and your whole day is ruined for hours on end. Similarly, when your child is in the midst of a meltdown, you cannot really reason with them. But if you recognize their sensory triggers and nip them in the bud, you can prevent a breakdown altogether and set up the child for success. And here are several steps for the how-to. Number one, acknowledge in words what bothers your child. Tell her that you are on the same page with her and give her the language. This is incredibly powerful, although it sounds very simple. For example, Elisheva, I see that it is so hard for you to tune out everything that is going on in the house and do your homework. When I was your age, it was hard for me too. I was so uncomfortable that I could not sit still. Did that happen to you? It was impossible for me to think because all the noise in the house drowned out my thoughts. This alone gives your child chizuk and a huge sense of relief. She is not the only one, and she is not alone. Next, anticipate when your child will have a problem. It could be every time there's a crowd, such as a carpool or a Shabbos meal, or your child's own birthday party. Reassure her without frightening her that you will warn her when an off-putting situation is coming up so she can prepare. You must be consistent so she will trust you. Next, we're going to collaborate with the child to generate socially acceptable solutions. You're the mom or the dad in the house, so whatever you set as socially acceptable will be acceptable in your house. For example, before homework, Elisheva, let's do 50 jumping jacks together, and then you can sit on your beach ball. Here's a list for you to check off for homework. After you finish each subject, I'll do another 50 jumps with you. Okay, now, let's close your door, get out your noise-canceling headphones, put on your favorite music, choose a gigantic gumball, and start. Here are a few more examples of sensory hacks. If your child cannot tolerate sound, tell her to sing and clap the loudest during choir or circle time. If your child cannot tolerate close proximity and play dates are a struggle, or even playing with siblings is a struggle, put a hideaway tent, a pop-up tent, that she can retreat to with impunity during a play date or a family get-together. Practice this so that she knows it's a strategy and not a cop-out. You set the tone for that. Alternatively, if you sense things are going to be overwhelming, send her on an errand to give her a legitimate reason to escape. There's no reason children have to be challenged every minute of the day. To minimize unpredictability, such as a birthday party or family gathering, this is my favorite strategy. Figure out together with your child where you can retreat to in that particular setting and just stand on the sidelines and observe if you need to time yourself out. Practice it. That makes it legit. If you can do it with her, then it's legit. practice it. Either get to the event early when things are calm so that your child can acclimate, or depending on her response style, plan to come late and spend a short but successful amount of time. Finally, recognize which times of the day push your child's sensory button. So, the mystery of sensory diet will now be uncovered. A sensory diet is an individualized planned schedule of activities that you develop, usually in consultation with an occupational therapist, to provide your child with the sensory experience he or she needs to effectively regulate his behavior or her behavior and interact with the physical world effectively. Your first step is determine the goal of your home program. Do you need a calming, grounding, and organizational strategy for an overly scattered child? Do you need an alerting strategy for a relatively lethargic child to ramp up attention and posture control? Or do you need to improve your child's body awareness and sense of body position and space to succeed at gym, at PE, and sports? Your second step will be to map out the day, and your third step will be to plug in activities to maximize success. Here is a sample sensory worksheet that I created for one particular child, which you will be able to download at the end of the webinar. In the second column, note that I listed the critical times of the day that derail this particular child, such as mealtime, pre-homework, and bedtime. And the third column is where I will list my sensory strategies. Your child with SPD may need a sensory boost at other times of the day not listed here. The next two slides, I actually have a sensory diet filled in with activities that might help your child. Don't flip out if you can't read them all now, because I'm going to be going over them on subsequent slides. But note, in blue are sensory strategies to calm and organize an overwhelmed child or an overly active child. And in orange are sensory strategies that can be used to arouse or upregulate a lethargic child who doesn't seem to feel enough. Caution, while your child may need alerting strategies during one part of the day in which she is lethargic and doesn't get enough sensory input, she may be overstimulated during other parts of the day when the stimulation is too much for her. So I will go over these strategies on the last set of slides. Let me briefly go over with you some principles that are critical in deciding which activities you're going to use. I see our time is short, so I'm going to go over with them quickly, but here goes. My first principle, number one, and I didn't make this phrase up, is when in doubt, probe it out. Proprioception, which is a probe, is one of the most powerful tools in the sensory arsenal because it's the most regulating. So when you suspect that your child's behavior is falling apart because of a sensory stimulus and you don't know what it is, provide proprioceptive input. To refine that, heavy work, slow, rhythmic activity, like rocking or pulling or pushing, is calming. Rapid, irregular, unexpected movement is alerting. And the other principle is to prepare for praxis. Do heavy-duty proprioceptive workouts to enable your child to feel his or her body in space to prepare them for physical activity. Okay, here's a list of numerous proprioceptive activities that you can work into your day, both for your sensational child and his or her siblings. They can and should be fun, not therapy-like. If you participate rather than dictate, you'll ramp up their enthusiasm. Okay? A word of caution. Children with sensory processing disorder, many of them thrive on predictability. Some thrive on novelty, but many need predictability. Every activity that you do should have a clear beginning, middle, and an unambiguous end. Otherwise, transitioning away from it will be difficult, and your child may end up being more disorganized than organized. For example, if you're going to have your child shovel the snow before homework, have her cut a path from the back door to the swing on one day and maybe from the back door to the grill on another day. Or if you're going to ask her to jump on a trampoline, decide in 100 times, say, or jump as you sing the ABCs. Okay, so here's a list of 15 proprioceptive activities to get you started. I'll just highlight a few. Raking leaves is a great activity if we ever see them again. At the moment, shoveling snow, which we have plenty of, is a great heavy activity. Climb a rock wall, use the monkey bars, unload the washer and the dryer. Your child can give baby brother a ride by pushing him around in a laundry basket, or give big brother a ride, which will generate even more resistance and heavy work.
Kaya, let me ask you a question. When you mentioned making sure that the children know the beginning, middle, and end of the activity, Yael questioned if you would recommend kind of picture cards hung to remind them of the different stages of the activity.
So for quick proprioceptive activities, I like to give a destination or a number. I like to have a Velcro chart that has a list of the activities of the day when I'm dealing with routine or the whole or a whole day. So while you can use picture cards, especially for children who are nonverbal, it's not always necessary because your proprioceptive activity is going to be between 2 and 5 minutes.
Right, so you can just say take 100 jumps or...
Exactly.
Right, gotcha.
Or jump on the trampoline while we sing the ABCs, and when we get to Z, we stop and we do the blah. There's always got to be a follow-up, so that it's very, very concrete. So for some children, picture cards will not be concrete enough for that.
Okay, great.
Okay. So now we've finally gotten to the times of the day, and we're going to discuss several times of the day that I've highlighted based on my client's particular, a consensus of my client's multiple times of the day. So, raise your hand if mornings are hard for your child. I'm hearing the hand raises. Yep. For many children who have sensory processing dysfunction, the morning starts the day not in a terrific way. So, first of all, mornings are difficult under the best of circumstances, but if you're dealing with a sensory-sensitive child, it can be daunting because the slightest thing can send your child into a tailspin, causing a flight or fight response. Your best line of defense is to be proactive, stick to your routine, and advocate for your child's sensory needs. Number one, and I cannot overemphasize this, avoid anything that is difficult for your child to part from. That includes especially TV, the iPad, or a favorite toy. Employ sensory strategies to get your child well-regulated before he leaves the house, and establish and stick to a routine. Children thrive on it even if they balk at first, and that's especially important for the children who are novelty seekers, who are looking for the next kind of sensation and don't stay in one place for very long. Let's talk about sensory strategies first. For children who are low arousal and sluggish, slow to get going, they benefit from multisensory alerting to the mouth, the ears, and the body. Here are some specific ideas. Wake your child's mouth up with minty toothpaste, mint sucking candy, or drinking from a sports bottle top. Stimulate their ears by setting your child alarm clock to play rock music with a heavy beat to get them up and running, or encourage her to play the kazoo or the horn. Encourage alerting movements, which you may not love first thing in the morning for yourself, such as jumping on the bed, breakdancing, or jumping jacks. You may actually have to join in to get a lethargic or sluggish child going. But children who are on overdrive and are overly excited in the morning benefit from calming sensory activities to provide deep, even, rhythmic input to the mouth, skin, ears, and movement system. Blowing bubbles employs deep breathing, which is a well-established calming technique. You can try jumping rope, pedaling a car or a tricycle or a bike, if those are well-established skills. Play calming music, or if your child is on a therapeutic listening program, this would be the time to do it. Provide deep pressure, which can take many, many fun forms, and let me give you one fun activity. You can either play hot dog or hamburger. To play hot dog, firmly wrap your child's blanket, roll her up in it, provide even pressure to her entire body. Next, lie on top of her to provide lots of resistant weight. To add calming, you and your husband or wife can each grab one end of the blanket and gently and evenly rock her, slowly unwrap. to play hamburger or sandwich, place your child between two huge pillows that will serve as the bread, and your child will be the good stuff in the middle. Be sure to squish the sandwich together with your body weight to tolerance as you add pickles, ketchup, mustard, etc., one at a time. If your child is on a brushing program, first thing in the morning is an excellent time to implement it. Okay. Routine is reassuring for sensory kids who often spin out of control and frighten themselves in the process. If your child seems to wander around aimlessly in the morning or seems unsure of what should be doing or gets lost while in the middle of getting dressed, create a visual organizer to show him or her what goes next in sequence. I would create a Velcro organizer with icons for every part of a routine. Organize, put download them from the internet, cut out little icons, put a Velcro dot on the back. Then take a file folder or a poster board, put a long strip of Velcro down it, and organize what goes on in the sequence of the day on this Velcro strip. That way, when your child completes something and moves it to the other side, they always know concretely what's coming next, and it gives them the illusion of control. But don't forget, sensory kids want control. They crave control, but really children have very little control. And this gives them the sense of control because they know what's going next. This can be very, very powerful. For instructions on how to create a Velcro organizer, check out my blog on PASOT.com called 3 Steps for Making Your Child's Morning Easier. And for children who have no concept of time, which is most children, you can set a timer for the most challenging parts of the day. And on my website, I also review a variety of apps for children who are a little older to help them manage their time more independently. Next, how many of you have difficulty dressing a hypersensitive child? Click on the hand raising if this is a problem for you. Okay, I see we have some interest here. So, if your child is overly sensitive, the good news is that I really feel, in most cases that I've seen, and I've seen a lot, the child is not trying to make your life more difficult. Uh-huh. For your child, it's not only uncomfortable, but often painful to wear clothing that does not feel right. And here's my best analogy, ladies. And gentlemen, please excuse me. Ladies, when we put on control top pantyhose, it is tight and uncomfortable at first. But, shockingly, within seconds, our tactile system acclimates and we no longer feel it. However, our children's tactile system, those who are tactile sensitive, never get acclimated. What bothers them when they put it on and touch it remains first and foremost on their minds, and they cannot focus on anything else. That's the way it pays for you to help them be comfortable, because they will spend all of their energy focusing on what is uncomfortable, and then they won't be able to do anything else that children are supposed to do, such as play, go to school, do after-school activities. I have a whole bunch of suggestions, which I would divide into shopping, choosing, and sensory prep. So first of all, some of these are obvious. Soft fabrics are best. Sweatpants, yoga pants, and leggings are much preferred over jeans. Let your child approve the clothing once it comes home. Children with sensory processing issues cannot stand buttons and colors. And I will tell you a really funny one, an adorable story. One of my very cute, very seriously Jewish little boys had a special sweatsuit for Shabbos. He just couldn't even wear chinos and a button-down shirt or a collared 3-button shirt to shul. A good trick is to try to pre-wash children's clothing before they wear them in the detergent that they're familiar with. That can be very comforting. Cutting out tags and labels is obvious, but there's also a really cool product called from undercovertape.com that covers annoying seams and tags that you can't get out. And there's also tagless underwear and shirts and seamless socks that are available online. I also strongly recommend spending 5 minutes doing sensory preparation before getting dressed, going to the shoe store, getting a haircut, or going to the doctor or dentist. As we discussed previously, proprioceptive or heavy work activities are the most calming and organizing. Okay, we're up to pre-homework prep. Your child comes home from school and is probably and maybe stressed to the max. This is a really important point now. Many children with sensory processing disorder are socially astute and manage to hold it together for the entire day, behaving perfectly in school as the stress builds up minute after minute, and they struggle to focus and attend to the teacher's voice by tuning out all of the ambient sights and sounds vying for their attention, such as the squeaking chalk, the visual distraction in the hall, and the chit-chat of their classmates. Between classes, they struggle to navigate the crowded, noisy hallways, noisy, smelly lunchrooms with fluorescent lights, and keep up in PE. By the time they get home, they have quashed their sensory needs for so long that they are like a powder keg about to burst. Some children arrive home like this in overdrive, and others are sluggish and lethargic. So how can we get them on track? Number one, if your child is hungry, and many children with sensory processing disorder do not even realize when they're hungry, start with a snack. But use food to your advantage. Provide crunchy, minty, or spicy snacks for your lower arousal child, such as barbecue chips dipped in hot salsa. For children who are overly responsive, bouncing off the walls and be grounding, give them foods that require hard work to chew, such as bagels, granola bars, or that require hard work to drink, such as a thick milkshake or yogurt or applesauce through a loopy straw. After snack, my strategy is, and I'm a mom who likes homework done the minute kids come home, but for children with sensory issues, they need to move for at least 3 to 5 minutes before sitting down for homework, and the time that you will put in will be paid back to you. Again, every activity needs a clear beginning, middle, and an end. And I would combine proprioceptive and vestibular input to help your child upregulate and proprioceptive input to downregulate for a calm alert state for learning. If the weather permits, you can try this out. You can try some of this outdoors. Calming and organizing jobs outside include raking leaves, shoveling snow, digging if you can ever plant, and heavy work that is goal oriented. Heavy rhythmic work, such as pushing out the walls, jogging, bicycle riding, and especially swimming are also effective. Actually, I recently came upon two terrific decks of cards called Therapy Ball Activities Fun Deck that have a whole series of cards with great activities that are really awesome as precursors to homework because they're calming, organizing, and feed core strengths that children can fit up for homework. If your child needs upregulating, a good strategy is to have them do something upside down, such as somersaults, inverted yoga postures, or headstands. For homework, children need to be sitting with their feet flat on the floor. Many children with SPD lack what's called background postural movements. That is, if you picture standing at the ticket booth online, everybody shifts back and forth and back and forth. Nobody stays still. Nobody stands still at attention except for Marines. Most of us shift our weight from one leg to the other. Similarly, when we sit, we shift our weight from side to side. Now, children who don't sense the vestibular and proprioceptive senses don't feel that urge to have that microscopic shifting when we sit. So what they do is they constantly move and barely sit still as they struggle to remain alert and attentive. So what one person might interpret as inattention, I might, if I know a child's sensory system, interpret as a struggle to generate this input to the joints and muscles and inner ear to allow that child to stay upright and attend. For a child who can't do that, who needs that sensory input from movement, if you make them sit still, they are likely to slide right out of the chair, and sometimes they land on the floor before they even know it.
Chaya, Kira's wondering, you know, for slightly older children who may be resistant to suggestions from parents, what would you recommend to kind of ease them into getting used to activities like this?
There are some really awesome things for older kids that I actually recently came upon. First of all, these boxes of cards that have core activities and upper body activities, those are oriented to older children. Another terrific set of activities I recently found are called Power Breaks. There's a little tiny book called Energizing Brain Breaks. Energizing Brain Breaks that you can get on Amazon that has all kinds of activities that are both intellectual, difficult to execute, and grounding at the same time. And those are two excellent things for other kids, but there has to be a buy-in. I think modeling from parents helps. Saying, I have this issue, this is what I do for it, do you have an idea for me, maybe we can do it together. I often find that when parents do something with a child and they don't just dictate to a child that they're a participant, that it makes an enormous difference. It's subtle, but it's an enormous difference. For example, I recently had a mom who started jogging because a child needs to, not because it's something she really cares to do. I had another mom whose child needed proprioceptive input, a 10-year-old, who she's a woodsy, outdoorsy type, not like most of us. She went into her backyard and chopped wood with him. So those are some ideas that I can give you. But you know what? For any child who's second grade or older, I would say you need to get them on the same team with you. It's helpful if they understand the problem. If you can teach them to tune into the signals that their body is giving them so that they can own it. Do you know what I mean?
You know, that's a great suggestion.
So, like, there's a program called the Alert Program, which is oriented to children 8 years old and above.
Can you repeat that? Sorry, Chaya.
Yes, there's a program called the Alert Program.
Alert Program.
Okay. Mm-hmm, I think it's by Schellenberger. It's available. You can find it on Amazon. The Alert Program teaches children to read their own sensory signals. So that how do you know if you're over alert, if you're bouncing off the walls, if this stimulation is getting too much to you? Well, some signs might be that you have pressured speech, that you talk, and don't wait for anyone to respond, that you feel flushed, that your heart is racing, that you're sweating. Those signals can be taught to a child to indicate to them that they're in overdrive. On the other hand, they may learn that if they're falling to the ground, they can barely sit up, they're breathing shallow, and they can barely, and their volume of their voice is very low, that they need some upregulating. The second step, after they learn to identify their body's own signals, is to develop an arsenal of activities in partnership with a parent or a therapist that brings them down into a middle range where they can function optimally, where they're not so tuned into their body and they can focus on their friends or their after-school activities or their homework. And that program for older children can be a beautiful thing. Okay. Some quick hacks for homework. Number one, don't underestimate the power of gum. Gum is rhythmic and often helps children stay on track. Drinking from a sports pop bottle also helps children stay on track because of the resistance that they apply. Music for children can be very powerful. Many children can tolerate music and benefit from music that we as adults can't tolerate. Another great hack is noise canceling headphones for children who need to block out all of the noise around them. Sarah, do we still have some time, or are we out?
Maybe just run through the rest, and people can kind of glance at the array here.
Sure. Okay, mealtime. We discussed previously using food to your advantage. You can use food to calm and to alert, and use it to your advantage. For children who have difficulty with their mouth, here's two quick suggestions. Number one, if your child is the kind who the food falls out of their mouth, they look really sloppy, they don't know the food is on their face, prior to eating, give your child's face and gums a deep massage. Another possibility is to exercise the muscles of their face, creating bubble mountains with loopy straws and food coloring, or blowing bubbles, or playing games with straws and pom-poms to play kind of a field hockey in order to generate the feeling before they eat. Another game I play with them is putting stickers on their face and having them find where it is to tune them into the sensation so that they don't look sloppy after they eat. And if all else fails, by all means, train them systematically to use a mirror before they leave the table. Bath time is happy time. So if you have a child who has a hard time transitioning to sleep, bath time is your friend, and here's how to do it right. First of all, because water has weight, almost anything you do in the tub is heavy work and can be calming. So first of all, for children who are hypersensitive to touch, make sure the water is deep and warm. Provide lots of tools and opportunities for heavy work and deep pressure, and this is really easy. Just provide them with sponges to wring out and washcloths. Fill a spray bottle with water and let them melt the foam monsters that you create on the wall. Dump and fill and have a tea party. Lots of possibilities here. After the bath, be sure that your towel is right at the ready to keep their body temperature even. This is very important for keeping them calm and not arousing them after this luscious bath. Then, apply firm, even pressure to dry up your child. Not like chop, 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 but deep rubbing massage, and then give a deep massage with lotion once they're nice and warm. And finally, bedtime is the ultimate transition, which is tough for kids, for many kids with sensory processing disorder. Respect how big a transition it is to go to sleep and provide an opportunity for your child to unwind. Here are a few suggestions. Number one, stay away from electronics for at least 2 hours before bedtime. A cartoon before bed really works against you because it's the multisensory stimulation that you get, sounds, the sights, and the movement will work against you and will alert your child rather than help him relax. As usual, develop a consistent routine so that your child knows what to expect. That's just good parenting. For example, dinner, a bath, a book, Shema, and lights out. Do not let the parent who's coming home from work in the middle derail you. That parent needs to respect the process because once your child's nervous system is stimulated, it's going to take him a long time to calm down again. I would keep everything soft, lower your voice, speak slowly, dim the lights, and ask your child for big hugs because the hugs that they give you rather than the ones that you give them are the most relaxing. If your child craves deep pressure or small spaces, I would try weighted blankets, a sleeping bag, or an enclosed bed tent. So I hope throughout this webinar you've compiled a list of some understanding of what sensory processing is and a host of strategies that you can implement with your own child. And I thank you for joining me.